I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back live streaming, and it's an impromptu thing. I know there wasn't a lot of advanced notice. I apologize for that. But there are some important current things that we need to talk about. And so I thought I would call some friends together, and I have Gadius Maximus here. Gadius, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing, Greg? Good to be here.
And the other guest I have is Pox Populi. Pox, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for inviting me, and good to be with you again, Gadius.
So guys, I had a number of questions that came in just from friends on social media, listeners, readers at Countercurrents, and I thought, okay, I'm getting enough stuff for an AMA, maybe I should just plunge ahead and do one impromptu. And the first question I got was about Alex Karp, who's the CEO of Palantir, which is a very interesting and ambiguous name because you don't know who's looking back through the seeing stones, right? They're inherently dangerous things. But Palantir is a company that spun off of PayPal, actually. And it was founded by Peter Thiel and Alex Karp and a number of other people. And basically what Palantir does is it collects a lot of data and analyzes it looking for patterns. And it is one of the architectures, I guess, of the snooping security state, the state that collates all of our records and spies on us, trying to put together basically patterns that might indicate terrorism or money laundering, stuff like that. It came out of PayPal's attempts to isolate things like terrorist networks and money laundering networks that were using their platform. So anyway, Alex Karp is CEO of Palantir. Palantir is an enormous corporation. They went public a couple of years ago. They are active all over the world. They don't work with the Chinese or the Russians, but they certainly work with most European governments who can afford them. And Alex Karp was at Davos at the World Economic Forum, and he made a couple of statements that ended up in the Swedish press and the international press. And basically, he said the following. We're very proud of what we're doing here at Palantir. He's there to sell his product, right? Davos, the World Economic Forum, is a technocrat's trade show. And this guy is hawking the wares of technocracy. And he said, we're personally prevented the far right from rising in power, especially in the Nordic countries. He's being interviewed by a Swedish journalist in one point. And the way that they did that was by preventing terrorist attacks. And the underlying assumption there, of course, is that, okay, if terrorism happens in a country like Sweden or Norway, who's going to be doing the terrorism? It's obviously migrants from the Middle East. And when migrants from the Middle East do terrorism, when they run down little girls and their dogs, blow up trucks, go on sprees with knives and machetes and things like that, that causes xenophobia. That causes nationalism to rise. That causes parties like the Sweden Democrats to gain in the polls. And one of the benefits of Palantir is keeping the right out of power by suppressing terrorism that makes people react negatively towards multiculturalism. That's basically what he said. And I thought, well, that's really interesting to have on the record. Maybe he should have thought more carefully before he spoke about this. But I just wanted to get your thoughts on this, gentlemen. Why don't you go first, Gadius?
I'm not really sure what this guy was talking about. I get vibes of like, what's that Tom Cruise movie? Minority Report, what he prevented crime. He knows like when a terrorist attack is going to happen, so his tech company prevented it or something like that. The guy, he just looked real goofy in the video that I watched, and he kind of seemed like he was just sort of, I don't know, like exaggerating what his company does. But it just goes to like the mindset of these type of people. Like when they talk about stuff like this out in the public and they say these things out in the open, and it's like, you know, just stuff that like 10 or 15 years ago you'd get looked at sideways for, you know, saying this is coming down the pike, and they're saying it out in the open. It's sort of just, it's kind of like a flex, I think. Like, you know, like, yeah, we can say this and there's nothing you can really do about it. And plus, if you say anything about it, people are just going to think you're crazy. It's sort of like the Great Replacement. They'll say it's a conspiracy theory, but it's a good thing that it's happening. And it's good. But if you say it's bad, then that's bad. So I don't know. I don't know what type of technology he's talking about. Frody made a couple posts about this on over on his channel on Guide to Culture. I'm not really sure what to make of it. It just seems to be just, you know, these technocrat types that just like to go out and say whatever they want. And us plebs just have to take it, is my thoughts on it.
Mm-hmm. Pox, what do you think?
Well, the first thing that came to my mind when I read about his proclamations, he said that, you know, had there been terrorist attacks, he was so proud of the work of his, you know, surveillance mechanism because it had stopped terrorist attacks. And then he went on to say immediately after that, had there been all these terrorist attacks, there would have been a rise of the right wing. And the first thing that came to my mind was that he doesn't care about the deaths caused by the terrorist attacks. It's not, had there been all these terrorist attacks, there would have been God knows how many lost lives, innocent lost lives, dead children, destroyed landmarks, destroyed monuments. No, his primary concern about terrorism was the reaction to it by Native Europeans. And Gaddis talked about his kind of weird appearance. He looks like a mad scientist, but he also doesn't pass the physiognomy check. This mad scientist isn't actually a member, shall we say, of the native Scandinavian peoples. And so I was just kind of struck and then ultimately disgusted by that, that mentality of, well, thank goodness we've stopped the trucks of peace and the explosive attire. And we've stopped things like the Bataclan massacre and bombs going off in the Stade de France and things like that. Not because I'm concerned about saving the lives of Europeans, European children, European families. No, it's because I don't want the type of politics that would make me feel uncomfortable to become commonplace. I'm afraid more of the reaction. We see this all the time.
Yeah.
You know, jihadists kill, jihadist goes on stabbing spree, kills a dozen people in a train station, fears of backlash growing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like Muslim community most affected. And it's like, yeah. What the hell?
Yeah.
So that was the first thing that came to my mind. I was just so disgusted by that.
Yeah. Yeah. The way their technology works is they are scraping data that you might think is private and they're reading patterns in it. And they're trying to use their tea leaf reading algorithms to find things that indicate terrorisms might be afoot. I can't imagine that they're doing this without simply reading your emails, reading your text messages, listening to your phone conversations, and scanning them with AI to find patterns. And then when they flag things, they pass these on to the police and the police investigate them. And the police sometimes end up preventing attacks from happening, right? Sometimes mm-hmm. the guy is just referring to the latest Anthrax album. And sometimes it's a guy who's trying to send Anthrax through the mail, right? You know, for every terrorist, there are probably 1,000 innocent people whose privacy has been violated, basically. Mm-hmm. And that's just how it works. So this is the architecture of the surveillance state, basically. So what Karp was admitting, first of all, is that we have a surveillance state that's strong enough to prevent terrorism. And if you actually ask, well, what do they have to do that? They're obviously, I mean, we've known this for decades now. They're obviously surveilling us all. Okay. The other thing is they recognize that diversity causes conflict, especially the Muslim kind of diversity can get kind of splody, right? Kind of stabby. And they need technocracy to to keep a lid on this. Now, our answer to this is, wait a second, why do we even have these people here in the first place? 30 years ago, 40 years ago, they weren't here. Can we imagine a world, a Europe, where they don't exist anymore, when they were a Europe from which they have all gone home? They don't want us thinking those sorts of thoughts, because that would mean changing the people in power. Davos is a trade show for the people in power looking for technological solutions to hold on to power. And so to manage the problems of diversity, apparently diversity isn't a strength if it takes a surveillance state to clamp the lid on. This is a fascinating admission. It's an admission against interest in a way. And yeah, the fact that he's so casual about this might mean that, well, he's not prudent, or it's a flex because he doesn't have to be prudent about this anymore. They feel so totally in control. But on the other hand, they realize that one explosion or two might be putting the far right into power elsewhere. So they feel threatened too, obviously. So it's just an interesting question, what's going on here. But there are two things that were admitted here. One is that diversity is a problem. Two, instead of reducing diversity or not exacerbating the problem, they simply want to spy on us more effectively to try and prevent the inherent violence of diverse societies from spilling over and threatening their power. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he pretty much just said, we know that flooding European lands with hordes of third worlders will cause, you know, violence and mayhem, but don't worry, we've got this tech, this, like, you know, oligarchical tech infrastructure to stop any terrorist attacks, so they can still come here. We'll just have to spy harder on you guys. You know, it's like a lose-lose. Like, you get the worst of both worlds because of it.
Yeah, we lose our freedom and we lose our country at the same time, and these people get richer, and the elites that desperately need to be circulated out and replaced before they replace us hold on to power for another election cycle and another and another. And maybe it'll be too late eventually for us if they just keep clinging to power with their fingernails, using every little technological solution that these people like CARP can provide.
That was the second thing that struck me, was how resilient the systems they have created can be. Because, as you both have pointed out, this is a solution to a problem that they caused, that they created. So on one hand, they will facilitate the arrival of boatloads of racial foreigners and some of the worst people you can imagine into European societies. They will even, they're starting to now, shepherd these people into the countryside and into European villages with populations of less than 1,000, and set up asylum centers, refugee centers, quote unquote, in these places, so that there's no escape. The urban areas, the cities, the mid-sized towns, these places have already been polluted, and now it's time for the countryside to be enriched. And they have the power to do that, and they have the means to do that. And then, to make sure that it doesn't get out of hand, to make sure that the disasters that they are bringing upon urban people, rural people, small villages, every square inch of a country, to ensure that that doesn't get too obvious, too on the nose, well, they will just establish this elaborate security and surveillance system to ensure that, you know, their experiment doesn't blow up too much in their face. And really, it blows up in our faces. We're the ones that suffer. And so I just was struck by how resilient it all is. And like the fact that they cause the problems, then they find the solutions. And the solutions are always more power for them and less liberty and less, you know, less of a functioning, safe and wholesome society for us.
Yeah, it's truly bleak and dystopian. Yet it's interesting that they recognize that it would be appropriate, if the people's will were actually expressed, for there to be rightist, populist, anti-immigration governments. They know what the people want, and they're damn sure that they don't want them voting for these sorts of things. And so, in a way, they're also advertising election tampering as a service, right? Elections are to express the will of the people. They know what the will of the people is, especially when it's goaded by these disasters. And so they want to be damn sure that the will of the people is not expressed in the elections that are facing them every few years. I think that's fascinating. We know that immigration is election tampering. They tamper with elections through social media. They tamper with elections by taking the president of the United States' Twitter account away from him. They put their thumb on the scale in all kinds of ways, tampering with elections. And what is that? Well, elections are ways that the will of the people supposedly expresses itself so that we can have peaceful change rather than violent change in society. And just as multiculturalism creates greater violence, so does censorship. So does the suppression of democracy. It lays the foundations for, down the road, violent social change where peaceful social change is no longer possible. They're not stupid, yet they constantly refuse to learn. They constantly refuse to learn from history. They want to stay in charge no matter what the consequences, and they hope that all the negative consequences can be externalized onto other people. That's the way toxic people work. They know that they are creating problems, but they always want to shift the problems onto other people to bear the burden, not themselves.
And what's also interesting about this surveillance state, this tech apparatus that Karp and his company devised, is that, you know, he's taking great pride in the fact that it's prevented terrorist attacks, which in turn prevented the rise of the far right, which he believes to be the most important accomplishment. But it doesn't stop the petty crime. It doesn't stop the, you know, the random stabbing every couple of months. It doesn't stop the car burnings. It doesn't stop the ghettoization of entire areas of a city. It doesn't stop the reduction in social cohesion and trust. And it certainly isn't stopping the sense of alienation and replacement that Native Europeans are justifiably feeling. It's simply, like I said earlier, it's this apparatus that's designed to make sure that the pot doesn't boil over. And yeah, that's quite insidious.
Yeah, that's a good point you bring up. It's like the quality of life in your neighborhood declines whether bombs are going off or not. I got a friend and he says stuff like, you know, like these people living around us in and of itself is terrorism. I mean, I wouldn't go that far, but you know, you get what he's saying. Like just the lack of like social capital and, you know, the quality of life going down just everywhere you go when you're exposed to these types of people. It's like, you know, you become alienated in your own country, in your own neighborhoods, in your own regions and everything. And it's like that's not like this guy's wanting to, you know, say, oh, we've stopped right-wing governments from coming into power because we stopped terrorism or whatever. It's like, well, buddy, you still have to deal with these other factors too. Like, you know, like I said, like the loss of like, you know, social capital and the feeling of alienation and everything. It's not just, you know, the bombs going off and the stabbings and the rapes and everything, which are horrible in and of themselves. It's also just everything else that it filters down into in society.
Yeah, the Davoisie don't have to worry about that as much. First of all, I don't think they worry all that much about alienation because I think they're the kinds of people who are more rootless than others, and therefore they don't feel homesickness. They don't feel nostalgia. They don't feel the consequences of loss of a homeland like most ordinary people do. Most people who have roots feel deeply pained by losing that sense of belonging in the world. But the people who rule us don't seem to have that same sense of belonging. And again, it's just another reason why we need a healthy circulation of elites. We need elites that are more rooted and that whose roots reflect our roots. We don't want to be ruled by foreigners or even countrymen who are highly alienated from us. We need governments that are actually composed of the people and the people who have the same preferences as the majority, basically. There's another question that I think comes up about Palantir and more broadly the surveillance state. And that's this. If these people have the power to filter through everybody's communications and flag certain words and patterns, and then refer things to the police that seem to be pointing in the direction of terrorism, why didn't it stop Peyton Gendron? Why didn't it stop the guy who went on the rampage in El Paso? I forget his name. Why didn't it stop Brenton Tarrant? That's a good question. If these people can stop left-wing terrorism, if they can stop Islamic terrorism, why didn't they stop those examples of terrorism? Did it escape them? Maybe. They could always, I guess that's what they'd say. I'm sorry, the system isn't perfect, right? And there are examples of Islamic terrorism that still happen that they haven't caught. But there's another and more disturbing possibility that needs to be entertained. It's a testable hypothesis. I don't have any evidence for it, but it's a testable hypothesis. What if these people, because they're afraid of right-wing governments coming into power, what if these people allow right-wing terrorism to take place? That causes predictable backlash. The backlash after Tarrant was pretty bad, just like the backlash after Unite the Right when a person was killed in a car accident was really, really bad. If these people have the ability to prevent terrorism, they also have the ability to allow terrorism to happen. And if they're preventing terrorism in order to keep ethno-nationalism out of power, why wouldn't they allow terrorism to also keep ethnic nationalism out of power, to stigmatize, say, the Great Replacement, which is an obvious truth, by connecting it with terrorist acts? Why wouldn't they do that? Are we to say that these people are incapable of such evil? These are the people who are presiding over the Great Replacement. Right? They're certainly capable of something like that. The question is, are they doing something like that? If they have the power to prevent terrorism, they have the power to allow it to happen. And beyond that, they have the power to create it if they want to. But let's just dwell on the idea that they might be allowing this to happen. What are your thoughts?
My guess is that, like I said before, he's just overselling what his company or whatever is doing. Like, you know, we can do this, this, and this, or whatever. And it's just an excuse. It's an excuse for more control, more spying or whatever, right? Like they use hysteria to sell everything to us. I mean, we've seen it over the past 3 years. We don't have to get into that. But I mean, even with anything like, you know, climate change or any other type of thing they're trying to sell on the people. But as far as not stopping right-wing terrorism goes, I could totally see something like that. There's plenty of evidence that the guy in Buffalo or whatever was being groomed, so to speak, by some former FBI agent. That's like a matter of public record. And also, it also gets to incompetence too. Like they just ignore it or they don't follow through on something. I think the shooting in Florida, the guy who shot up the school in Florida that started the Students March for Our Lives or whatever, he was being monitored. Like he'd been reported to the FBI multiple times and he had a YouTube account that said, I think the name of it was Future School Shooter or something like that. This was back during when the FBI was investigating the Trump world or whatever really hard. So it was sort of like an ironic thing. Like, you know, you guys were taking your eyes off the ball as far as like terrorism goes. And I think it plays into like incompetence mostly. And, you know, they don't, and also he's probably just selling like snake oil as far as like, what he can actually do with it. I don't think it's Minority Report level yet.
No, but, maybe not.
But I think that's just what's going on. It's just an excuse for more like for the overlords to gain more power or whatever.
It's probably true that we sometimes overestimate the powers that be, right? But I would caution against underestimating as well. I've seen enough documentaries, I've listened to enough podcasts over the years featuring NSA operatives, FBI operatives, MI5 and MI6. They have some pretty significant tools at their disposal. And when you look at, in the American context, how frequently the Department of Justice and Merrick Garland repeats over and over that the biggest threat in America is domestic terrorism from the far right and white supremacists. At some point, they're going to need a justification for that claim. And I don't know if Palantir is used in the United States. I think it's mainly a European service, a dystopian service. But it's this more or less the same situation in Europe as well. I mean, just look at how the Irish media and the Irish government, the Irish state, is currently trying to paint Irish protesters, the Irish who have stood up against the demographic replacement of the Irish people and the constant arrival of these non-refugee refugees into their communities. Well, they're all being painted now as the far right, neo-Nazis. Plants are being planted amongst the groups of protesters. And so it does seem to be, as is often the case, it's not a question of the what, it's all a question of the who. It's not that terrorism is some great concern of theirs, that they really want to stop terrorism. They want to keep leftist terrorism, Antifa terrorism, jihadist terrorism. They want to control it. They want to thwart it. It seems like that's not really their goal. It's that they want to just prevent the kind of terrorism that's going to provoke right-wing nationalist sentiment. Because after, you know, a various, you know, quote-unquote white supremacist or right-wing terrorist engages in an act of violence, we don't hear about white communities fear backlash after lone gunman attacks a school or something, or anything like that. So yeah, it seems like it's more about, again, containment than, and containing a particular who, than it is about containing a what, which is the terrorism. And I think, you know, it gets into conspiratorial, some people might call it even schizo land talk, but I do believe that what Greg Johnson said has some merit. If they can boast about, you know, thwarting all of this terrorism, then it does lead one to ask, well, then why wasn't this, you know, Andre Breivik prevented? Why wasn't another, you know, why wasn't the right-wing act of terrorism prevented? Are some of these allowed to happen because it suits the narrative? It suits the agenda? I think that's a legitimate question. And we know from the history of America that there are numerous legitimate, genuine false flags that the CIA engaged in over the years. So I definitely think that's a valid question.
Yeah, I'm sort of taken aback by being the guy who's standing for the schizo position in this conversation. but I'm just going
to
live with that.
Welcome to the team.
I guess I'm on team schizo now. Well, but I agree. I do think that if they have the power to stop terrorism, they also have the power to allow it to happen. And it is certainly a question, an open question, a question that maybe we'll solve someday after the present regime falls and we can start, you know, future historians go through the records and find how many levels of fake we're on, just how much of that was allowed to happen. I believe that certainly the Israeli government knew that there was going to be a terrorist attack on September 11, 2001. And I believe they allowed it to happen because they wanted to leverage that for their own benefit. That is possible. People who have the power to prevent terrorism have the power to allow it to happen. And these are not nice people. These are not ethical people. These are the kinds of people who would allow it to happen if they could gain some kind of advantage from it. So I guess the big question for me, though, is what do we do? What do we do with this technocracy? Do we wish that it would all just go away? It's an open question. Do we want a world where this technocracy doesn't exist? Do you want to go first, Gadius? What are your thoughts on it? Can we put that genie back in the bottle? Would that be the most desirable outcome?
I don't necessarily get too worked up over technology per se, like the advancement of technology. I know there's a lot of people in this sphere that are Uncle Ted K respecters, and he's got really valid points, and it's obvious that he's spoken a lot of truth, you know, in his writings and everything. But I see it as a double-edged sword. You know, obviously what we've got going on is a form of technocracy, or leading to a form of technocracy that obviously needs to be stopped. It's not even up for question. I'm more aligned with Morgoth's view on this. If this thing gets instituted, like if the thing that they want to happen gets instituted, all the other goals that any political movement, including ours especially, any of those goals that we want, they're just going to be a moot point, because we would be powerless against it. So yeah, I'm definitely a technocracy disrespecter, and that's why I've never like countersignaled any, you know, like anything. Well, okay, within the realm of reason, but you know, when the schizos get on their thing about this or that happening, this or that person saying these things out loud in a public forum in Davos, you know, what they want to do, what their plans are, I say, yeah, we should take them at their word, take note, and be against it, and do what we can to stop it. So I think it can be put back in the bottle. I think technology, you know, like I said, it's a double-edged sword. We can use it for good, and obviously it's being used against us, and the oligarchs, the ruling class, whatever you want to call them, they want to use it, you know, to control the masses or whatever, make sure we're nice little docile cattle and everything. And the thing about it is, like a lot of people, that's just what they want to be. They want to be docile. They want to be fat and happy. And, you know, it's that's the bad aspect of it. But it's also, you know, you see, like with everything, it can be used for good too. So like the technology that allows people to organize protests that we've seen over the past month, organize, meet up with like-minded people and everything, spread the message, spread the memes, spread everything, you know, it's also a useful tool too. So, you know, I'm white-pilled by nature. I think in the end we're going to win, and it's just something we're going to have to, you know, something we're just going to have to keep plugging away at.
Yeah, I personally feel that the technology issue is probably like the overarching issue. It's the meta issue, and pretty much anything. You could say this also about immigration, as far as, you know, politics and things like that. But I think a lot of our, you know, ills are downstream from technology, and it's important to make the distinguish of, you know, the good side and bad side of technology, and the kind of technology that's a tool. I think when we talk about dystopian technocracy, we're talking about the things that, as Gadius mentioned, Ted Kaczynski already wrote pretty much the book on these issues. And I don't think it's a question of putting the genie back in the bottle. That's impossible. But it is true that if you look at the technocracy that's being crafted, and the future that Davos Man has envisioned for us, all of it is very organization dependent. It's technology that requires a massive system of interworking dependencies. And we know through history that, we know from history, that these collapse, that these deteriorate because it's just such a massive maintenance endeavor. And so whether it's Roman aqueducts or irrigation systems, sanitation systems, methods of construction, the knowledge gets lost, or the interlinking systems of dependency, you know, those links are broken at some point. And so it just becomes, once one link of the chain is broken, the whole chain becomes dysfunctional, it becomes useless. And so that has happened. And I think, you know, that's why some people are quite black-pilled and accelerationist, and they yearn for a collapse, because they see that, perhaps justifiably, as the only way that this dystopian technocracy can falter and waver. As far as the bad side of technology, I think it's that what we're seeing implemented, things like Palantir and the things that are presented at Davos, and these things do eventually become reality. I mean, just look at some of the stuff that we're already using, like Google Glasses, smartphones in and of themselves. I mean, just look how their use has exploded and their capacities have exploded since the relatively recent time that they have been on the scene. You know, chips in your palm are real. Talking about Scandinavia, that's where a lot of people are starting to use them. So what I think is the dystopian part of this is that, well, it's two things. It's advancing very quickly, and so most humans aren't able to keep up with it and adapt to it, and we don't know what the consequences of all of this really advanced tech and quickly advancing tech are. And the second aspect, which I find the most important and the most negative, is that in many cases, this technology is imposed on us. We don't want it. It's imposed on us. So you have to get a smartphone. You have to start working from home, sat in front of a laptop screen. You have to get this chip in your hand now. You have to pay with a central bank digital currency, et cetera, et cetera. It's imposed on us. And so the other solution, apart from waiting for a break in the chain of all of these interdependent technological systems, is simply to willingly detach yourself from that. And there are quite a few people within our community who have done so and are now even making content, telling their story and giving advice on how they do that. And I think it's valuable stuff, even if, you know, for example, me personally, I'm probably nowhere near able to homestead or set up a cabin in the woods, but I still think it is a good idea. I think it's an interesting alternative. I think there's a lot of validity to taking that path. And I simply like watching and learning from the people who have done it and listening to their perspectives and, you know, sharing that. But I think that's pretty much the only thing that someone who is averse to all this tech can do, is just detach themselves as much as possible.
If I can follow up on that just real quick, there's something to it about offering an alternative, you know, like instead of the tech dystopia, offering like a positive vision of like what this side of things would bring to the table. So I think it's something like, you know, tech utopian or tech futurism, something like Guillaume Fay's novel, Archaeofuturism. It laid out a pretty interesting take on what the future might look like if this sphere or the globe took like a rightward turn or whatever. And that's pretty cool. It's like, it's sort of like we still have all this rad technology. It's not like this huge, the world's not going to be a giant Costco or giant Walmart. It's going to be right. Like, you know, people will have their own little villages and hamlets and everything. And all the important stuff will be taken care of by meritocratic elites, often in the distant capitals or whatever. So I think it also comes back to offering a better mousetrap to people, a better, more positive vision, instead of just, you know, decrying technology and,
well, it's a tool. It's a tool, like you said, and tools are used by humans ultimately. An example would be TikTok. TikTok is clearly one of the most degenerate applications out there. It's clearly bad news, but it depends on who's using it, because apparently the TikTok in China is nothing like the TikTok that is in the West. And the TikTok in China promotes videos, I guess, right? Short little videos. And they promote, the algorithm in China promotes art, science, improvement, health, whereas the algorithms in the West promote trannies and self-mutilation and sexual degeneracy and all sorts of things that would contaminate a society because it's being utilized by evil hands, shall we say. Whereas in China, apparently, this is what I've seen, that the algorithms in China promote, you know, pro-Chinese, pro-nationalistic content, videos about art and glory and health and science and achievement, whereas the algorithms in the West promote, you know, the kind of stuff that we all know exists, you know.
But it's the Chinese that are putting those algorithms in place for China and the West.
Right, exactly. So it's an example of how, depending on the humans controlling the technology, it can either be something positive, like Gaddis was saying, promoting, you know, national pride and inspirational content, or it can be used to completely contaminate a society.
Yeah, yeah. That's very interesting. Russia has similar propaganda for similar purposes. Somebody pointed out, I think it was on Telegram, that Russia today promotes anti-transsexual stuff in the United States and pro-transsexual propaganda in Latin America.
Wow.
Why is that? Well, because transsexualism is a thing in America, and so they're promoting dissenting views mm-hmm. against it. Whereas in South America, Catholic and traditional, mm-hmm. it's not a thing. And therefore, what they're promoting is the narrative of the poor, oppressed transsexuals. And they're just yearning to breathe free. And why are you being so mean to them? And all that tearjerker propaganda. Why do they do that? Well, because they are against basically the current thing in any society that exists. They're promoting the overthrow or the degeneration of any system that's not their own. And they're willing to promote diametrically opposed messages to different societies. I look on that and I just think that is the behavior of a cancer on the planet. The Chinese do the same thing. At least the United States promotes transsexualism equally in its domestic and foreign propaganda. At least the United States is principled about this. I'm being facetious there, but there's something truly bizarre and sinister about that. For me, though, there's an issue that I want to raise about technology. Okay, I've written a couple of articles. I wrote a piece called Technological Utopianism and Ethnic Nationalism. And I wrote a piece called The End of Globalization. They're both flip sides of the same issue, basically. And the point that I make in the Technological Utopianism and Ethnic Nationalism piece is that really since the end of the Cold War, really since the beginning of the end of the Cold War, detente, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, we have seen a decline in technological innovation in the West. Technological innovation in the West was driven by two factors primarily. One was expensive labor. We can thank the labor movement for that, and we can thank difficulties in immigration and difficulties in global trade. And the other thing it was spurred by was our global superpower rivalry with Russia. And because of those characteristics, the 30 years after the Second World War, basically for Europe and the United States, were fantastic years for the middle class, and they were fantastic years for technological progress. It was just amazing how much more productive people were, how middle class and working class living standards rose during that period of time. And as soon as we started getting a unipolar world, as soon as the Cold War was over, and as soon as globalization economically was off and running, and this really started in the 1990s to take off, but you could see seeds of it already in the 70s happening, we started seeing the collapse of the middle class in America and Europe, and we started seeing technological stagnation. And we are now in a strange situation, and Peter Thiel talks about this in his book, Zero to One, and I think it's very valid. America isn't as high tech as it used to be. And technological advancement has stalled in almost all sectors except computers and the internet and, you know, smartphones and stuff like that. We are not sending men to the moon. We're not sending men to Mars. We are not creating thorium reactors. We're not coming up with free, clean energy for the entire planet or anything like that. We're just amusing ourselves with handheld devices while society declines around us. And that really is true. What the technocracy that we're looking at is a very superficial thing in the context of overall technological stagnation and even decline. Living standards are declining. The future prospects of younger generations in Western countries are bleaker now than they were in the past. We are now looking at a world of managed decline into this ghastly post-historical global society, where basically, because we have no barriers to moving people and goods, global standards of living are going to equalize. That's predicted by basic economic theory. Global standards of living will equalize. And that means that the billions in the third world will live a little bit better, and the people in the first world will live a lot worse.
That needs to happen, according to Louis C.K.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I thought you were going to say according to accelerationists, but yeah, apparently Louis C.K. as well. It shouldn't be here.
What a dickhead. Yeah, but here's the thing. The technological stuff that we fear is primarily the tools of this global class that's managing the decline. These are their tools to stay in power while they basically stagnate and destroy modern civilization.
It's astounding how resilient the regime is and the systems that they have created are, but it seems that there's a lot of effort expended on maintenance and just, like I said earlier, making sure that nothing boils over.
Yeah.
And I'm reminded of something that happened a couple of days ago. I don't know if you guys saw this. Apparently, somewhere in Britain, some diversity hires attempted to repair a nuclear reactor had busted a bolt or something. And instead of like repairing it properly and refastening the bolts, you know, proper bolts on this particular apparatus, they use glue
in a submarine.
It was a nuclear submarine or something like that. Yeah. It's just unbelievable. That's what you're saying. Quality of life in our countries, in our nations, is going to go down drastically because of diversity hires and mass immigration as well.
Yeah, yeah. And so we have this idea, you know, that, you know, technology is dramatically progressing, right? And yet humanity is declining. I mean, dysgenics is a real thing. The quality of the people who reproduce is bleak. Smart people have fewer children, if they have children at all, compared to dumb people who don't give a shit about the world. And we've got these two trends are simultaneous. And there's going to come a point where the increasing stupidity and chaos that is spawned by dysgenics is going to make it impossible for technological innovations to basically innovate our way out of these problems. Eventually, it's going to come crashing down because the human factor is declining. And I'm sorry, but I don't believe in strong AI. I don't think that we're going to actually create, autonomous intelligences. We're just creating instruments to be used by idiots who are running things. And the instruments are only going to be as good as the people running them. I'm pretty certain of that. They're not going to AI their way out of this. And so what I'm looking at is a brief period where we are going to be transitioning from a first world technological society in isolated parts of the world to a global slum and a global plantation economy where everything is very low tech, where people have miserable short lives, and where there is a small group of people running everything, and they will use technology to hold on to power and negotiate their way through this decline. And they're going to hope that they can hold on to power, even though eventually even the technologies that they're using are just going to become unworkable. And we're going to have a low-tech, oppressive dystopia. That's what the real future is. That's what Davos and these people are spoiling for. All these people who want to get rid of industrial civilization, what do you think that means? It means a low-tech, impoverished world that they control. It's going to be a global plantation, a global slum, and it's going to be low-tech for everybody eventually, because technology is not going to be something that's going to be widely available when the population just becomes extremely stupid on average. When the global IQ, the global average IQ is simply the IQ of everybody on the planet, except for a tiny elite that's running things, it's going to be low-tech perforce. It simply can't be anything but that. So I don't even think that the technocracy is going to be all that technological. I just think it's a transitional phase to a very bleak step backwards into a pre-capitalist form of life. Only by the time this process is over, there will be no diversity on the planet. Everything will be the same sort of brown, impoverished global favela. It's pretty bleak.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of what you said there got the noggin jogging. There was a lot that I agreed with. And actually, one of the, I think the first thing I wrote on my Substack, if I may be so bold as to shill it, I hardly ever actually write anything on there, so I can't really say this is much of a shill, but it is an essay called The Man of Extinction. And in that essay, I posit that we are approaching, and I don't know if this is going to happen in our lifetimes, beyond, I don't know what the time scale is, but I feel like we are approaching it. I feel like there is some groundwork already being laid. And we are going to come to a point where, you know, like you said, because of dysgenics, because of the, you know, mixing together of all the peoples and diluting their individual characteristics and capacities and abilities, we're all going to be just, you know, this gray mass of, you know, not entirely creative or people with a lot of impetus. It's just going to be very, you know, kind of middling. And what I kind of disagreed with and some of the things that you said there is that I do think, though, that there's going to be enough technology to sustain this. I don't think it's going to come crashing down. I think that there's going to be it's like life support for all of these. And we're already kind of seeing it. Think about, you know, all of the people in particular, you know, these leftoids who are taking antidepressants and, you know, they can barely function in society without having a safe space or trigger warnings. These people are not cut out for life, but they are kept on life support. The system supports them. So we do get the safe spaces made for them. We do get the trigger warnings put in front of books or, you know, controversial material for them. We do have systems that enable these people to keep living a life that is subpar, that is inadequate for proper function. And we see this with the transsexual people. You know, they're clearly not right in the head, but we have now technological systems that are enabling them to mutilate themselves and do all these things so they can present as what they identify, even though they're clearly not people who are, again, cut out for life in society. And they also are taking all sorts of medications. And so I'm actually quite kind of worried, maybe, like, what word do you want to use? Black-pilled about it, demoralized, I don't know. Realistic, I suppose. Because I just feel like there's already so much dysgenics, and there are already so many people in society who are clearly just kept on life support by this technological apparatus that we have. And, you know, being very harsh, I could say that perhaps I'm one of them. You know, I depend on roadways and I depend on supermarkets to be fully stocked, and I depend on supply lines to function and to flow properly. So, yeah, I think that you're right about that this Gen X and the fact that we're all going to become this kind of middling IQ mass. And then I think that there's going to be enough technology to maintain it. It won't come crashing down. And that's what kind of why I wrote The Man of Extinction, because this happens in history. We see the cycle of empires, for example. They go through a moment of collapse, kind of does all come crashing down. But then there's a rebirth. There's a renaissance, right? But what happens when you've kind of eliminated the people who are capable of making a rebirth? Because, okay, you could say that the European peoples are capable of this. But what happens when the European nation has been so diluted with sub-Saharan Africans who have an IQ of 70 to 85? Well, now there's no more ability for a renaissance, for a rebirth. Now we are stuck. We are the men of extinction.
Yeah. One argument that can be made here about technological progress that I think is very powerful. I remember when I was an undergraduate and I took a course on technology, and it was done by this leftist. Of course, they were all leftists at my university. And he was really anti-tech. And I wrote a final exam that made this guy furious with me. He was angry. I still have it somewhere in my papers. This angry rebuke that he wrote at the end of my little blue book. And I basically said, look, we can't stop with the technological progress. We just can't. Okay. Why is that? Well, because we have started on a path where we depend on non-renewable resources, right? In the past, civilizations could rise and fall and so forth because technology was always pretty simple. And given the level of technological power, we could get along. But what happened when we started learning how to, for instance, burn oil, right? Well, we started out by the oil that was just in pools on the surface of the ground. That's the beginning of the oil industry. They were scooping up puddles of oil, right? And then once they had scooped up all the puddles, they had to start drilling for it. So they needed new technology. Now they have amazing technology because they have to go deeper and deeper and deeper into the Earth's crust to get oil. What would have happened if they had not been able to improve the technology that they had at the very beginning of the use of oil? Well, we basically wouldn't have been able to continue burning oil. We would have used it all up. We would have used it all up because what counts as a resource is not just the stuff. It's the stuff that we can access, and we access it through the existing level of technology. And as technology advances, more and more things become resources for us. And so we set off on this process of technologically extending our grip on the world, our ability to mobilize things and turn them into resources. And at each step of the way, we used up the stuff that was available at a previous lower level of technology. And our populations burgeoned. We created complex new social forms that were all dependent upon this continued technological progress, because we needed that to keep, well, getting oil, right? If you want to talk about any other resource, it's the same story. Well, what would happen if technology just stagnated? Eventually, we would run out of the resources that would keep the whole system going. Well, could we then just say, well, let's go back to an earlier form of technological society? Well, you couldn't go back to an earlier form of oil-dependent technological society. Why? Because all the easily accessible oil has already been used up. And so if you pause, you can't just take a step back. You can't say, let's dial this back 50 years. If you pause, if you stagnate, you go all the way back to the beginning. And you lose everything that was made possible by the progress since the beginning of that, say, the oil industry cycle or whatever. And so that would be a catastrophic backward collapse in civilization. Billions would die, right? Literally. And many things that are possible would become impossible all of a sudden. And so the point is that all these anti-technological people who are dreaming of maybe we can, you know, slow this down. Maybe we can dial it back a couple of decades. Maybe we should put more of our energy into social justice rather than technological progress. All these dreamers, actually, they cannot be taken seriously, because if we listen to these people, if we allow them to pour cold water on technological progress, if we allow them to stagnate our society, if we allow them to stagnate things through dysgenics or just dreaming about utopian possibilities that are never going to happen, right? If we start dreaming about world of racial equality, and if we decide that we're not going to make Black people upset by sending Whitey to the moon anymore, right? It will collapse, and it will collapse all the way back to the form of civilization that we had before we set foot on this technological treadmill. So we just have to go forward with it, and we can't listen to people like that. Well, this professor was just livid, because I thought it was a really powerful argument for saying we simply can't avoid moving forward with technology. We can't pause. We can't dial it back. We simply have to plunge ahead. And if you actually look at the bright leading lights of our society, the opinion makers and so forth, none of these people are really bullish on technology. They're all bullish on certain things, but all of these are forms of control that they can use to hold on to power in a declining civilization with declining living standards, with renewable energy and all this nonsense, all these fake panaceas that they put forward. They're not serious about technology. They're serious about control. And that's, I guess that's the thing. You know, the technocrats aren't really all that bullish on technology. They're simply bullish on techniques of control, because most of these people really are envisioning a world where everybody has less. Everybody has less food, less freedom, less space to live in. That's the kind of world that they are envisioning. That is a low-tech, oppressive world that they want to control.
What's the slogan? You'll own nothing and you'll love it, or you'll be happy.
You'll own nothing and you'll be happy, right? Yeah.
I actually know the guy that they used in that advert, the really? Famous smiling guy with the curly dark hair behind that slogan.
Okay.
He lives in, he's from the town I live in, Spain, and I've actually met him on a couple occasions.
And does he have nothing?
No, actually, what's so funny is that he didn't know exactly what they were using his image for. Like, he's a struggling, starving artist actor, and he didn't know what it was going to be used for. And the irony is that he's actually one of the few people I met in my town that was totally against the, you know, quote unquote Great Reset and the World Economic Forum and all these things. He was actually one of the few people who was woke to the whole thing and hated every aspect of it. And yet he's the face. He's literally the face of it. He's the face of the slogan.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. We had a very bitter laugh about that. But that's how it played out.
Well, I bought this package from one of these image hosting companies. I think I paid 360 euros a year. And it is a unlimited use of still and video images. And what I'm doing is I'm working with a video guy to make videos of talks of mine, or, you know, audio presentations of my articles.
Nice.
And it's so hilarious, because I've seen two of them now. They're in draft form. We'll start getting them out next week. And I'm hearing my voice saying terrible, terrible things, blood-curdling, mind-chilling, mind-bending horrors over the images of these happy, smiling people. And I'm sorry, but I paid for it. I got the license. You can't stop it. You're the face of white nationalism now. And I just think it's hilarious. So
that's funny.
You know, we can, it goes both ways, right? They can use our images, we can use theirs. So
fair play, turnabout's fair play.
Yeah. So folks, if you want to ask us questions, do it through Entropy. Go to entropystream.live/countercurrents, hit the green button. You can take out your card and send us a super chat. We very much appreciate it. We have bills to pay. And I have a couple questions here, and I would like to just dive in. So first of all, Eddie has sent in $1,400. Holy moly. Sweet. That is very generous. Wow. This is a lifetime paywall. So thank you very much, Eddie. Get in touch with orders@counter-currents.com and get your lifetime paywall set up. We very much appreciate it. Doug has written in with $30. Hey, Greg, happy new year. If in the future gene editing were to become advanced enough for someone to be able to change their racial characteristics, would they in effect become that different race? Is this an important ethical dilemma you can foresee happening, worthy of serious consideration or no? I think it's a really interesting question. If people can use gene editing to change their genes, would they become a different race? Well, if you define race by genetics, yeah, I suppose you could. But what would they be doing? Would they simply be changing their superficial characteristics, right? Because I don't think race is just skin deep. I do think that what is going to happen is this. We're going to find this happening. As genetic editing becomes possible, and it'll start out by doing embryo selection and stuff like that. They'll fertilize embryos, and then they'll do genotypes, and they'll say, this embryo is going to be taller than this one, so do you want to flush the other one? That's the kind of stuff that's going to go on. There, people will do that. Then they will start actually tinkering with the DNA so you can make your children have certain characteristics. What is the likely outcome of that? Will that be eugenic? I guess it depends on the people who are making the decisions. Will people become whiter? if this is done, again, it depends on the decisions of the people who are doing this. But I don't know if you could literally change a race. I mean, that's a lot of characteristics, but you can certainly change a lot of traits. And so that is a possibility that we can face in the future. The thing that is disturbing is that there's a distinction between a person and a thing. We think of ourselves as persons. We demand to be treated with respect. When somebody treats you like a mere thing, it gets our thumos activated. We get angry. We feel dishonored. We want vengeance, right? We want justice. Things are just things. Buy them, you sell them, you consume them, you throw them away. When human beings become things, when they become the sort of things that can be manufactured to the preferences of their parents or technocrats or trendsetters or social media influencers or whatever, we're crossing a line. We're crossing a line between being recognizably human and being simply a product that is being manufactured for the, you know, the preferences of other people. Something deep inside me is just revolted by that prospect and wants to say, no, we can't do that. And we should never set one foot on that slippery slope. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you're having a kid and the doctor says, well, there's a 1 in 4 chance that your child will have cystic fibrosis or something like that, and we can eliminate that with genetic therapy, I would say you'd be crazy not to do that. Does that make your cystic fibrosis-free child a manufactured thing? Or is it just your child that you have spared from a horrible disease and death? So I worry about these. I mean, the issues, these are real issues.
I worry about the fact that we have some of the worst people considering the ethics of these things nowadays. You know, it doesn't seem like, to the extent that these ethical issues are even thought of, they are thought of by the worst types. You know, these are the things that Yuval Noah Harari writes about and thinks about, and he just is loathsome, loathsome. Yeah. I don't see anyone of a better nature contemplating these things. It seems like it's all being thought of by the absolute worst cast of villains you could imagine.
There's a little book by C.S. Lewis called The Abolition of Man. And he talks about this potentiality. And he says, there will come a time when the entire future of the human race will be something that can be controlled in the hands of a few people who've unlocked the genome, basically, who have control over future human evolution. Or it won't be evolution anymore. It will be the manufacturing of human beings. That's an astonishing amount of power to concentrate in the hands of a single generation. But there will come a generation where that power exists and where everybody from then on is basically made to order, made tailored to their preferences. And I do not want to live in a world tailored to the preferences of Davos Man, Yuval Noah Hariri, or any of these other mad scientist types who show up to lecture at the World Economic Forum. I do not want the future of humanity to be controlled by the TED Talk people.
Yeah, I hate to keep going back to the movie references, but it gives me Island of Dr. Moreau vibes. You know, there's also like gene editing. Well, I mean, that's like sci-fi territory or whatever. There's also like gene editing themes that go on in the Warhammer universe too, about, you know, making super soldiers. I don't really see the current crop of elites getting into something like that. Like Pox mentioned, Yuval Noah Harari. He's always talking about, oh, we're not going to need very many people in the future. It's just going to be he's painting this rose color, what he thinks is like a rose colored future, but it sounds, you know, ridiculous and terrifying to a normal person. And it's like,
who is this we? Who is this royal Davos?
Exactly.
We? Yeah, but it's also like, I mean, like I said, turnabout's fair play. We can say, oh, well, you know what? We don't really need you guys in the future. How about that?
Which is true. And Morgoth made a great video about that where, even as I think he made this over the summer, and there is a moment in the video where he says quite effusively, we don't need you need us, or something along those lines. And he was talking about, again, like I was sort of alluding to earlier, all these systems of connectivity and dependency that give Davos Man the lifestyle that he bathes in. You know, that he, this glorified elitism, well, that's dependent upon a lot of things that you need us for, really. What I find most terrifying about Harari, though, isn't, you know, the, oh, we should reduce the world's population to only 500 million or something like that. Okay, that's clearly insane. I could be kind of misanthropic sometimes, but I don't think reducing the population to 500 million is going to be very pleasant. And I assume that I'll be in the list of people getting cold. I am under no illusion about that. What I find most disturbing, though, is what he, and I just saw this recently, there was a woman at Davos on the podium giving a typical like TED Talk presentation. They just think of everything as data. Everything is data. Your emotions, your decisions, your reactions, they want to monitor your brainwaves to know when you're not paying attention as much to the TED Talk, when you're not being as productive as you should be at your useless, meaningless office job. Harari has said, you know, free will, that's no more. That doesn't exist. You can have a philosophical argument about whether or not free will exists, but Harari just writes it off as it doesn't exist because we control you now. We manipulate you. You're just zeros and ones that we can program. It's just all data. And that to me is, again, like the man of extinction. It's just so cold and gray and dystopian and meaningless. Who would want to live like that? Even if you can have all the arguments you want, and the poets, that's the thing, not scientists, artists, poets have been the ones that have most tried to answer the question, what is love? What is free will? What is anger? All these things. Because you can't just reduce them to data and zeros and ones. It's just so, I don't know. How would you want that? Why would you want that view of things? It just seems so anti-life, so cold. I just find that very, very unpleasant.
We have another question here from ABC, who gives us $10. Thank you. And it's a similar question. What is your stand on genetically modified humans? The Chinese already promote genetically modified embryos. Before you answer with an astounding no, consider this: a few decades down the road, hundreds of millions of highly intelligent, motivated Chinese will compete with the West. And I do think that that is another way that we have to look at the technology thing. Being anti-technological is basically unilateral disarmament when you get right down to it. If we say we're going to get off the technological treadmill, that makes us basically playthings in the hands of the people who don't. We are giving up power. We are laying down power. Other people aren't. And therefore, we're basically making ourselves sub-historical. We're taking ourselves out of being actors in history and making ourselves into the kind of people who can be easily pushed around by the people who aren't opting out from the race for power. And technology is power. I mean, that's what it's all about. Certainly the kind of power that we're talking about when we're talking about geopolitical competition. Making things, but especially making destructive things. That's the ultimate thing that we have to worry about. And if we stop, others won't. Therefore, everybody sort of feels like we can't get off the treadmill. We can't get off the treadmill unless everybody else gets off at the same time. Or there's a global government and therefore one person decides for everybody and there's not going to be that competition. That's a dystopian problem on its own. It's never going to happen. We have a world of competing power blocks. And if we basically lay down the quest for power, others won't. And eventually they'll simply tell us what to do. I think that's totally valid. What do you think?
I think to answer the question about how you feel about genetically modified humans, gene editing, and China doing it in the future, like, you take the material they're working with, like Pox was talking about. I don't think, and regardless of what China does, they can make, you know, they can bring a few years ago. It was a couple decades ago, actually. Now, you, man, getting old. Anyways, apparently there was this NBA player named Yao Ming, and supposedly he was bred to be as tall as he was. And he played in the NBA for a few years, and he was actually pretty good. And you just think about the material they're starting with gene editing. Like, they can, you know, you can breed people to be big, strong, fast, whatever. But like Pox was saying, I don't think you can program the Faustian spirit into the Chinese people. So it's not going to, I don't really think it's, mm-hmm. I'm really skeptical about that. I don't think it's going to be as, you know, scary as it's made out to be, as far as that goes.
It's a very good line. You can't program the Faustian spirit into the Chinese people. Put that on a T-shirt.
Would they even want that? They wouldn't even want that, though.
Yeah, exactly.
That would
yeah.
be the end of the Communist Party's power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't have much to say on this. All this sci-fi stuff is kind of beyond me. I've never really liked sci-fi, and it doesn't really fire my imagination for good or ill. I just kind of indifferent to it. But a thought that had just occurred to me was in the context of gene editing and, you know, trying to manipulate genes to create quote unquote better people. I think Europeans are pretty good just the way we are. There's an argument that, you know, due to post-industrial lifestyles and you know, modern diets of mostly convenience foods, that we have fallen short of our ancestors, our pre-industrial ancestors in some cases. You know, I've seen archaeological reports of skeletons from the Bronze Age, female skeletons that were dug up dating back to the Bronze Age that had far better bone density and bone strength, jaw shape. Our ancestors, even in going back quite ancient, and even in the medieval period, which is often depicted in Hollywood films as being so drab and gray and dirty, they were actually quite healthy. One could even argue that we've kind of paled in comparison in some important areas. But overall, I would say even today, the modern European, the modern white man and woman, we're pretty good. I don't want to make genetic modifications to European peoples. I think we're quite good as we are. Now, if we have to do it to make super soldiers and Warhammer 40,000 in a Warhammer 40,000 world, okay, I suppose that, that necessity becomes real. But outside of the situations that you mentioned, Greg, about, if you had a baby that was going to be born with cystic fibrosis and you need to do something about that, yeah, I'm in support of that too. I would be in favor of that kind of quote unquote modification. But other kinds of modification to sort of improve people, I think we are pretty good already, is what I would say.
Yeah, I don't think throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, the sphere, it's a eugenic respecting sphere. So, I mean, gene editing, just like anything else, it's a double-edged sword, and it depends on who's wielding the sword, I suppose.
I just don't want the world of the future to all look like Yuval Harari. I just don't want that to happen. Somebody said to me years and years ago, if this was an unkind response on my part, somebody basically made this point years ago. If we have easy, inexpensive gene editing, won't Black people make themselves look whiter? And won't there be some kind of convergence on a certain set of traits that are largely white? And I said, honestly, no. I think that if you went to the housing projects of Atlanta and offered them this technology, they would want their kids to be born with cornrows or gold teeth. There wouldn't be a convergence towards some kind of white ideal. There would just be a sort of a nightmarish fixation on current, sort of bad taste, right? Basically, they would stamp today's bad taste on their kids. People would be giving birth to children with tattoos already on them. that kind of horror. I don't like that idea, obviously. Yeah. That is definitely a possibility. There was this couple in San Francisco. I never got to know them, but I would wait at a bus stop with them, okay? And they were white people. They were rather both tall and large, but kind of flabby white people. And they were covered with tattoos. And at a certain point, they had a little baby. And I would see them with the baby. And the baby was just this angelic little, very white child. And I just wondered, what is this kid going to be thinking as, I think it was a she, as she grows up with these strange tattoo-covered manatee-like parents, these strange creatures, right? And I was so glad that they didn't have the ability to have her born with ear gauges or something already in place. But that is one of my fears, that if you had this kind of technology, you wouldn't see improvements to people. You'd just see permanent fashion mistakes. You'd see fashion mistakes encoded in the people's genetics and forced upon future generations. And I do think that that's obviously a horrifying possibility. We have a couple questions here, and I want to get to them. And they're related. All of these questions are related. Okay. Anders wrote in, and he said, what do you think of the strategy that we could call homesteading, meaning that you move to a very rural area and try to become as self-sufficient as possible in terms of food, education, and so forth, similar to what Amish and Mennonite communities do? Would it be good for the cause if many white families left the cities and suburbs and went to live in sparsely populated rural areas and with a self-sufficient, low technological lifestyle, and hopefully have a lot of kids. Okay, that's a thing in our sphere. It's a meme in our sphere, right? The homesteading lifestyle. I am not going to criticize it too much because I do think that's an option for some people, but I don't think it's an option for our movement as a whole, for race-conscious white people as a whole. Basically, for a reason that we've already touched upon, which is to give up on technology is to give up on power. And we can't give up on power. We can't basically hand the power to control the future of humanity over to the people who have it currently and just retire to our Amish communities and hope that they don't send drones in to destroy us one day, or robots to destroy us one day, or force all of our children to marry non-white immigrants someday. We can't do that. It's laying down power. And the only thing worse than being in the rat race to gain more power is being off on the side of the road, just having power done to you because you have no ability to resist it. Ultimately, we're not going to win against the current establishment by out-dumbing them or by being weaker than them. We're going to win by being smarter than them and by being stronger than them and by being more ruthless than them. And that means by pursuing power. We have to pursue power. And that means we can't just cede the cities, right? We can't just go to the woods. Power is concentrated in urban areas. That's why they move their proxies in to squeeze us out of urban areas, is because that's where the power is. And we have to contest power wherever we can. We have to contest it on every level. In the countryside, yeah, sure. But on every level of the political system, from the county to the state to the nation state, we have to contest power. And the Amish lifestyle is basically conceding that and just hoping that somebody will allow you to exist in their future dystopia. And I don't think that that's a very good bet. I do not want to have to depend on the good graces of the people who rule us to have a future. We need to have power over our future. And so homesteading as a movement as a whole, I think, is a bad thing. Now, some people who they just want to have kids and they want to live in the countryside and they like dogs and, you know, gardening and stuff like that, it sounds wholesome. But we can't win entirely by being hobbits. So that's just my thought. What about you, Pox?
I pretty much agree. I don't have too much to add. I spoke about this in a video I recorded a couple of years ago, and it ended up being about 3 hours long, and it's called tradophilia.
Tradophilia, that's a great one. I like that.
I do feel like there's a bit of tradophilia, which is, it's coming from a good source. It's positive propaganda. It's offering a positive vision. So I don't necessarily criticize it, just as you don't criticize. I do think it could sometimes be over-idealized. And I would say that, in particular, when we're talking about European cities, some of these are the most beautiful cities ever built, and it would be a shame to, you know, surrender them to the hordes of invaders and malcontents. But part of homesteading that I think is a good idea to do would be in response to some things that have become a bit more important lately. So, for example, not being dependent upon food supply system that as of January 25th in the European Union is now going to be incorporating, you know, cricket flour and mealworms into pizza dough and beer-like beverages and things like that. You know, the state of agriculture, the state of the soil, the state of livestock, the health conditions of these things in the macro scale, the factory farm, the battery farm context, it's quite poor, the health and the condition of these things. And so if you wanted to homestead and raise your own chickens and eat healthy, fully healthy eggs and fully healthy, you know, fruits and vegetables, and form a community with other people, your agricultural neighbors, you sell them some eggs, they help you on in your garden, then you get some sheep or some pigs, and now you have more livestock and sources of protein and dairy and things like that. I think that's a good motivation. But if your motivation is to escape the tentacles of Globo Homo, you're probably going to fail, because there is no escape. There's only resistance now. Like I said at the top of the show, there are schemes all over European countries to send these new arrivals into the small villages and rural communities. So there's nowhere really to escape to. You just have to resist now. And you're right that it's in the urban areas where that's where power is centralized, and that's where resistance will be most effective.
Yeah, we should be in every European capital. What are your thoughts, Gadius?
Yeah, I'm a huge woodlander respecter, and I watch all his videos, and I like what he's doing. That's definitely a route everyone should at least look into taking. At least have some sort of plan B, at least for, you know, in case things don't go the way we need them to go. I'm really interested in stuff like that. One of my things is separating yourself from the system. That's a big thing for me. But there's ways to separate from the system while also staying in society too. I mean, you don't have to go totally off grid. You can just, you know, there's things you can do, like canceling your Netflix subscription or something like that, little things. But it also gets to this thing I've been kicking around of, you don't want to cede territory to these people, and you don't want to just, it's all over, man, and we got to go. It's like, no, you got to bully your way back into play society. You got to contest power where it's at and where you can, and, you know, have the willpower to mold the, you know, your community and your society back to the way you want it to be. Don't just, you know, let these people trample all over you. So it's like, you know, that's one of the things you can do. Just contest power where it's at, like show up to the, I don't know, like the city council meeting or something. And even if, like, you know, let's say you're relatively well to do or whatever, or you know, you've got a good thing going on. It's only going to get better if we go out there and say no, like, you know, like the protesters in Ireland are doing right now. And that's one of the things that I think is really needed, just going out and basically imposing your will on it. So as far as, like, you know, homesteading and prepping and stuff like that, I'm all for it. You know, I'm like, I'm from the backwoods myself, and I appreciate stuff like that. And like I said, I'm a woodlander respecter and everything, but, you know, plant your flag where you're at. Where I'm at is my home, and I'm not I'm not just gonna run off into the woods. I'm gonna fight for my own territory.
Yeah, that's really well said. I would like to go to a question from one of my favorite listeners, Anne Frank Rizzo. Love that name. Who sends a $5 super chat and has the question: has the elite class in the West also suffered dysgenically? I think it's a great question, and the answer is yeah, definitely. I love to look at the difference between Norman Podhoretz and his son, John Podhoretz, or Irving Kristol and his son, Bill Kristol. These are wonderful illustrations of what's called regression to the mean, where you have parents who were highly accomplished, and then their kids were more average. Of course, the fact that their kids are more average didn't impede these kids from taking up the mantle that their parents had. So John Podhoretz is a neoconservative intellectual like his father, but just a really lame one. And the same thing with Bill Kristol, just a lame knockoff of his father. So that's one thing. There's a regression to the mean, and that you can't even call that dysgenic, really. It's just what happens when you have extraordinary parents. Their kids are going to be a little more average. Okay, but then there is the simple fact that elites today have all kinds of dysgenic attitudes. So for instance, elites today are more likely to engage in race mixing. And most race mixing is quite dysgenic. When white people breed out, they generally are breeding down. And even if you could say, well, you know, you're going to have a smart half Chinese child or something, they're still not us, and they still have identity issues, and they're still not, on average, as attractive as they would be if you just had a child with a member of your own race, to be perfectly honest. And so race mixing is dysgenic. Race mixing is very widely practiced amongst elites. Also, elites are very much more likely to have small families or no families at all, because our elites are all about climate change and being environmentally responsible and stuff like that. Years ago, I wrote a little piece called Why Environmentalists Should Have Large Families. And it's a very simple argument. I actually gave this to a couple of students of mine when I was back in the normie world. They had just gotten married and they were attractive people. And they were very much into green stuff, the environment. And so they'd been married about a year. And I said, so when are you beautiful people going to start having kids? And they got a little quiet and they were a little worried about the environment. And I said, look, that is to your credit. You care about the world. You care about the future of the world. And because you care so much about the future of the world, you're going to leave less of a mark on future generations than the people who don't give a shit about the future of the world. And is that good for the world? Is that the responsible thing to do? Unfortunately, many, many people who are college educated and higher than average IQ have heads full of nonsense, and they didn't have that simple 2-minute speech delivered to them. And so they have opted out of the future, but that has not prevented people who are completely immune to those sorts of considerations from having large families. And so the next generation is going to consist of more people who don't care about the future. And the next generation after that will have a higher and higher percentage. And you can see the trend. So the elites are very dysgenic in a lot of ways. They race mix, they choose to have small or non-existent families, and they select their good traits out of the gene pool. So yeah, the elites in the West are suffering dysgenically. And in fact, some of them are leading the way. We have to recognize that sometimes our enemies are simply trying to push us off the cliff, but they don't want to go off the cliff themselves. They're saying, come on, go over the cliff, go a little closer to the edge, you know, have an extra little drink, you know, have you tried heroin? You know, they're trying to egg us on to self-destructive stuff, but they don't want to destroy themselves. They just want us to destroy ourselves. But a lot of our elites are vanguards in destruction. They're vanguards of nihilism. They are leading the way into nihilism and destruction. And they suffer disproportionately from those consequences. They're not preaching nihilism to us and healthy values to themselves oftentimes. They're leading the way. They're further ahead than we are. Pox, what are your thoughts on this question?
Oh, yeah. Don't really have too much to add. I think you summed it up pretty well. I would just say two words, Jacinta Ardern. There's the answer to your question, if the elites are suffering from dysgenics.
What about you, Gaddius? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, when I saw the question pop up in the Odyssey chat, my mind immediately went to Sam Bankman-Fried and his girlfriend. So I think the answer to the question is an obvious yes.
Yeah, the distressing physiognomies of the people who are destroying the world. Somebody had that meme of Sam Bankman-Fried and a few other people and had this little line about their distressing physiognomies. Yeah, I mean, they're definitely horrible to look at, but they're not having kids either. So That's an interesting factor. A lot of the elites are disproportionately infertile. And, that means each future generation is going to be more spitefully mutated, smaller, perhaps, and more spitefully mutated than the current generations. And what that means is that it's going to be easier and easier to pry their hands off the levers of power someday, we hope. At least that's one of the reasons that we have for hope. There was something said earlier about the situation with highly technological society, where it just becomes so complicated that it can sometimes break down. And I was thinking of a wonderful, amusing illustration of that from the Terry Gilliam movie from 1985, Brazil. You know, it's supposed to be a technological dystopia. And you see how impossibly complicated and bureaucratic everything is. And the best illustration of that is the stuff in the walls. You open up the walls and it's just filled with this pulsating mesh of pipes and tubes, and it becomes unsustainable. Nobody can maintain this whole system. And what that means is that maintenance workers become like outlaws. They have all this inordinate power in their hands because the system, everyone's so dependent upon the system, the technological infrastructure, and they have no way of controlling it themselves. I always thought that was a very funny image.
About the technological, stagnation or whatever, if, the IQ gets reduced to the mean, you think about what's going on in Africa right now. You know, the Chinese are building infrastructure to mine, rare earth minerals or whatever out of there. And you think about the meme of Empire of Dust or whatever it was called, it's also tiresome. And you think about what would happen if the Chinese just up and leave, right? Because they're building all this infrastructure, all these like power grids and everything. And what would happen if they just up and leave and divest out of Africa? And you think it'll chug along for a while, it'll chug along for a good while, that the Africans will be able to, maintain the power grid for a while and things like that. But after a while, it's just going to reduce back down to the mean. They're going to end up back where they were before all the Chinese came in with their technology and all that.
Well, decolonization in Africa in the 60s and 70s was a great illustration of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. What would happen if the people who make the system work all just get up and leave? And it was especially true in Angola, which was a Portuguese colony in Africa. In the 70s, the Portuguese decolonized in a big hurry and fled. And Angola just seized up, went into reverse, and collapsed, basically. A lot of the infrastructure collapsed because the white people who maintained it just left en masse and in a hurry. So yeah, there are plenty of historical examples of how that works. And if the Chinese pack up and leave, it'll happen again. It's just the way it is. I have one question here from my friend Sutton. And the question is, are the Irish beginning to hate? Well, let's go to Pox. Pox, you've been following what's going on in Ireland. What's happening? And is this a reason for hope?
As Nick Gilvey has called me on more than one occasion, I am party pooper Pox. But when it comes to the situation in Ireland, I'm going to have a change of form. And I actually think that what's happening in Ireland is cause for positivity and is worthy of support. And we should all be lending encouragement. The Gael has risen up and they are doing things so well from what I've seen. Things are getting a bit hairy now because the system is reacting and it's going to react, I think, in very insidious and forceful ways. But from when this all kicked off in East Wall in November, the way that the Irish protesters and the Irish people, really, I think there also seems to be just overwhelming support the way they've carried themselves and the way they've carried out this these blockades and these protests, the reason I'm positive, I feel positive about it, is because they're doing things correctly. And so they have clear demands, for example, in comparison, or in contrast rather, I suppose, to the Canadian truckers, for example, last year, who didn't seem to have clear demands, and they went to the wrong target, because it wasn't really the federal government from Ottawa that was mandating these truckers to present a vaccine certificate. It was mainly provincial governments making those decisions. And so there wasn't really clear demands. There was a raft of bad actors and infiltrators who latched on to that. Whereas the Irish protests against basically ethnic cleansing of Ireland, the invasion of Ireland, they've been really good at keeping that at bay since the start. If you read the press release that that they made when they were doing the blockade Dublin port in November, it just, you couldn't have phrased it better. They said, we don't want any politicians getting involved. This is not a political party movement. We don't want any political parties getting involved. This is an outpouring of the sentiment of the Irish people. And then they said, we will be here every day, or I think it was like every Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. We will be here every day of those days of the week until this asylum center project, this plan, is scrapped. We are not going anywhere until it's scrapped. So they have clear demands and clear objective, and they're keeping the bad actors at bay. So I think it's been really, really great to see. And there's been some victories. I just saw today a headline out of the Irish Times said that hoteliers are refusing to accommodate these so-called migrants, these fake refugees, these invaders, because they are afraid of protests and public pressure and bad optics. So they're not doing it. And it's not Ireland, but not too long ago, there was the town in England, I believe the name of it was
Lenton-on-Ouse.
You know, town of, I think, like 500 people or 1,000 people, something like that. And there was a asylum center planned for their little community, and they protested it, and they were successful. The plan to set up an asylum center in Lenton-on-Ouse was scrapped. So I think, you know, usually I'm not a big fan of protests. I thought that many of the lockdown protests were ineffective. I thought the COVID, the Canadian trucker protest, was going to be ineffective. I think I was right on that. I said the same about the Dutch farmers protest. I don't wish for these protests to be ineffective. I wish they were effective. But I think there's just constantly the same mistakes are made. But I don't see those mistakes being made in Ireland, as far as I'm aware. And I've also been told that it's probably going to get even bigger. So we can look forward to it going nationwide. It's not just going to be in areas of Dublin anymore. So just great news coming out of Ireland. I remember when I made my YouTube channel in 2018, I spoke often about how much concern I had for Ireland and for the Irish people. You know, the native Irish population of Ireland is somewhere around 4 million. It's a very small number of people. You can wipe that out within a couple of generations of mass immigration. And when I started making videos in 2018, Ireland hadn't really got to the level of, say, France or Germany or Sweden, but I knew it was going to happen. I knew it was going to happen. I knew Ireland was going to be in the crosshairs. And that really broke my heart and also infuriated me. And so I made a lot of commentary about Ireland, you know, trying to warn or prepare the Irish for this eventuality. But I also always had hope that when it did come to Ireland, when replacement migration, global homo, whatever you want to call it, accelerated and boiled over, I always held out hope that the Irish would be amongst the best to resist it and to react to it, because there is such a strong identity. And it's very recent, even. You don't have to go that far back. to see normal Irish people, Irish heroes, Irish figures who are admired universally talking about Ireland being for the Irish. It's an ethnostate. So I think that there's a lot of fertile soil, literally and figuratively, for the Irish, a strong identity. They know who they are. They don't want to be replaced. I saw a great sign, one of the pickets signs that was being waved at one of the protests, just said it so clearly and perfectly. And it was one of the signs that you don't see often. But in Ireland, they said it. This person was brave and coherent enough to say it. And it simply said, mass immigration equals ethnic cleansing of the Irish people. That's it. They got it. They understand. And they're speaking up and they're standing up, and just full support to them. It's great to see.
Yeah, absolutely. I pretty much agree with you 100%. This being different from other protests before, I haven't followed it as closely as you, but what I have seen, it's been really white pilling to see this happening in Ireland, because it's like, you know, they're not screwed around. And I will say, I think it was me who coined Party Pooper Pox last year about the trucker protest. I think our disagreement came down to what we considered a win. I'm more of a PR victory type, you know. I think that constitutes a win, but you know, like the content, right? Starved for content. But yeah, you're definitely right. This is 100% like more serious than any of the other like populist type uprisings we've seen. And it's been very, very white pilling to see what's happening in Ireland and in the UK with PA every weekend so far this year. Yeah. They've been out there every weekend plugging away at it. And it's something that should be cheered on, something that should be supported, something that should be magnified by everybody in this sphere. Stuff like that happens, it just snowballs and it you know, it becomes like a feedback of, you know, motivation for people all around the world. Like,
and it worked at Lenten on Ouse. Sometimes we are so demoralized and we love to dispense the black pills that we forget or we aren't even aware of when we win. You know, on some occasions we actually do win, and it worked in Lenten on Ouse. They stopped the asylum center from being brought to their little town, and I hope it can work in Ireland as well. And the fact that it's going to go nationwide, because it's very important that it's not just confined to some areas. It's very important that all of the nation, whether it's Ireland or it's the French nation or the Swedes, that they all realize, no, this isn't just a Stockholm problem or a Malmo problem or a Banlieues in Paris problem. This is affecting our entire nation. And we all have to band together as a nation, as a people, and resist it and end it and reverse it eventually.
Absolutely. I think that we have to talk about remigration. We can't just talk about making it legal. We can't just talk about stopping it. Once it's stopped, it has to be reversed. And we have to have a workable, humane model for remigration, for reversing these trends. These trends they're not natural phenomena. Open borders, air travel, dinghies full of people being pulled, you know, coming ashore all the time. These are not natural phenomena. These are engineered. These are social engineering experiments. These are the products of political decisions. And equal and opposite political decisions can be made, not just to stop this, but to undo it, to reverse it. And we have to be absolutely clear about that from the very beginning. We have to reverse this. And I like what's happening so far in Ireland, and I really do applaud them. You know, Ireland, a little more than 100 years ago, was not an independent nation.
Exactly.
They fought for their independence a century ago. It was a bloody, long-fought struggle. And then to just see it being pissed away by globalization within a couple of decades.
What was it for? What was it for? All of that bloodshed, right? That's what Jonathan Bowden famously says in one of his pub speeches. What was it for? If you're just going to be replaced in your own homeland by foreigners and your entire nation state is going to be subverted. What was it for? And I think a lot of Irish people feel that, and they're particularly the Irish nationalists, they're not afraid to say that. They're not afraid to say, this is not what our great grandparents fought for in some cases. You know, it's we often talk about, you know, within living memory. That's literally true for many people in Ireland. And again, that is so important. That is such an important base to build from, to build on. And, you know, yes, there are plenty of Irish shit libs and open borders types and libtards. They're a disgrace, but they're easily dealt with in a country like Ireland, who fought so hard for independence not very long ago. And the fact that an Irishman can say, you are a disgrace to our great grandparents, I think is something really, really powerful.
Yeah.
Right. And you can't trot out the tired old song and dance routine about this is payback for colonialism.
Oh, right? You know what they do in Ireland, which is so, it's just so evil. They always, there's the anti-whites, the anti-Europeans and the brainwashed Europeans who have been, you know, taught to hate themselves. They're so evil. They have a response for everything. So with the English, it's, you know, you need to be punished for colonialism. With the whites in America, it's you need to be punished for slavery, et cetera, et cetera. What they're doing in Ireland is they're trying to say, well, the Irish have no reason to complain about mass migration into their country because the Irish emigrated to other countries. And it's just like, yeah, well, the ones who are in Ireland, those 4 million who are in Ireland, they're the ones who stayed. Exactly. Yeah. They're the ones who stayed. They're the descendants of the ones who stayed. And that is still their home. And also, there's no comparison between an Irish family, like my ancestors, getting on a rickety ship to go to America to work in copper mines and to help establish a town. There's no comparison between that and a Nigerian who's coming to Ireland and getting handouts immediately, getting free housing immediately, and who comes there, openly saying, not begging even, demanding these things, and then throwing a temper tantrum if he doesn't like the food or things like this. There's absolutely no comparison. We're talking about the Irish who stayed and the descendants of the Irish who stayed, and also the ones who didn't stay went to countries that didn't give them a welfare state open arms welcome. The Irish who went to North America, or the Irish who were sent to the penal colonies of Australia, they didn't go to these places with a golden handshake and a warm welcome from a state with, you know, healthcare systems, welfare systems, social safety nets, all these handouts. No, not at all. So there's no comparison at all.
Absolutely none. And the point that you made at the beginning, these are the descendants of the people who stayed. The argument just falls dead as soon as you point that out.
I think they try to do that with one of the Scandinavians or Northern European countries too, that didn't have a colonial history, but they sold whale oil to slave ships or something. And they make that excuse. That's why they have to have mass immigration.
Yeah. You're being punished with all this enrichment. I love the contradictions there.
Exactly.
You're going to be enriched and you deserve it good and hard.
Yeah. It's always, first you say, you know, demographic replacement. So first you're told it's not happening, but it is, and it's a good thing. And also you deserve it. Huh?
Yeah. Yep. Well, gentlemen, I've really, really enjoyed this conversation. I'm glad to get back to streaming occasionally. I kind of have missed it. I needed to take a break at the beginning of the year. Last year, at the end of the year, was super stressful, and I just felt totally burned out after the new year. And I thought, well, I can just cross this off my list of things that I feel like I have to do. But as soon as I didn't have to do it, I started wanting to do it. So I'm glad to be back at this. And I'm not making any promises because I've got a lot of crazy stuff going on in the rest of this month. But we'll definitely have another episode in the future of Countercurrents Radio. So, Pox, how do people follow your work?
Well, I am mostly on Telegram. That's kind of where I will make a few posts daily. And then also that's kind of the central hub where I promote anything else that I'm doing, whether it's a live stream for my YouTube and Odyssey channels. For example, I just had Gadius on as one of the guests on a panel discussion. So occasionally I'll do like special occasions on those two video platforms. I do have the Substack, which I mentioned earlier. I haven't paid much attention to that for quite some time. I'll try and get back to that. But yeah, Telegram is where I'm at. And then speaking of streams, I usually do stream exclusively for Telegram on Thursday nights. So people can tune into that as well. I try to keep it a cozy stream. No black pills, no complaining party or raging. Pooping. Yeah, no party pooping. I encourage people to tune into that.
Gadius, how do people follow you?
I usually hang out on Telegram too. If you can find Pox's page, you'll be able to find mine because there's a lot of crossover there. But I don't really shill my own stuff. I would like to spotlight American Krogan though. He's been hanging out in chat and he's got a project in the works, the Fallout mod, and I think it's coming along nicely. And I think that's a type of activism this spear needs too, like stuff like that, you know. So that would be what I would shill, American Krogan's channel.
Excellent. Thank you both. And we will be back sometime in the future with another episode of Catapult's Report.